Cantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Live at Jackson Station, Music, Community, and Tragedy in a Southern Blues Bar by Daniel M. Harrison, narrated by Gary Bennett. One often finds courage and principle in unexpected places. Benjamin E. Mays. Introduction. Yeah, I'm going back to that shack way across the railroad track. That's where I think I belong. The Grateful Dead. Throughout the 1980s, Jackson Station Rhythm and Blues Club of Hodges, South Carolina, was one of the liveliest places to be. The remote music venue, which was housed in an old railway depot about 80 miles due east of Athens, Georgia, was one of the premier hotbeds for rhythm and blues, not only in the state, but also across the southeast. The club advertised a comfortable, relaxed, really laid-back atmosphere. It brought a cosmopolitan sensibility to the South Carolina backcountry and a stage for local celebration. For about a decade, Jackson Station buzzed with eccentric, effervescent people who came together to socialize and appreciate live music. Matty Pfeiffer, erstwhile guitarist and singer for the all-female blues band The Sensible Pumps, describes the scene this way. Packed, full, fun, everybody partying, dancing, real eclectic mix of people. Jackson Station didn't know class or race, it was just a place where people from all walks of life came late at night. On Friday nights, folks flocked to Jackson Station from across the region to see southeastern blues artists and national touring acts on their southern circuits. Bands would often play their music until 5 o'clock in the morning. Such operating hours were not the only scandalous thing about the place. Jackson Station was owned by two openly gay men, Gerald Jackson, 1946 to 2010, and Stephen Bryant, 1952 to 2012. These men may or may not have been called queers, faggots, or pole smokers behind their backs by less tolerant members of the tiny, conservative, Christian town they lived in. In 2020, South Carolina still lists buggery as a felony offense under its code of laws. However, Jackson and Bryant operated Jackson Station in the 1970s and 80s, many years before the United States Supreme Court ruled in Lawrence v. Texas, 2003, that state laws criminalizing sexual relationships between individuals of the same sex were unconstitutional. In such an historic climate, it seems quite remarkable that the impassioned, enterprising efforts of these two individuals, as well as Gerald's mother, Elizabeth Jackson, 1922 to 2001, that Jackson Station developed the distinction of being one of the South's best blues bars. It was like Smokey and the Bandit meets Boys in the Band in outer space, said the Reverend Billy C. Wirtz, the avant-garde piano blues man and one of the first professional musicians to perform at Jackson Station. It was like no place on the planet you had ever seen. Jackson Station was part church, part carnival, and part diner, recalled Atlanta-based guitar legend Glenn Phillips, one of the top guitarists in the nation, who played the club many times during its years of operation. Other regular performers at Jackson Station, and who will be discussed later in this book, include the new wave band The Swimming Pool Cues, 1978 to present, famed rhythm and blues singer Nappy Brown, 1929 to 2008, and jam band giant Widespread Panic, 1986 to present. I loved playing there, said Widespread Panic bassist Dave Schools of Jackson Station. We would play until we would either ran everybody the hell out of the room or they were tired of serving those drunks. I do recall the sun coming up at least once or twice. Jackson Station was the embodiment of the best in the American honky-tonk, juke joint, roadhouse, blues bar tradition. The fact that the club had once operated as a railroad depot made it even more unique. Of course, as Georgia blues guitarist Tinsley Ellis notes, there were places like Jackson Station in other states. That wasn't the only place in the world like that. Musicians like myself and Delbert McClinton and all, we've been playing places like that our whole career. Jackson Station was just the epitome of it. Like the best blues clubs, like the one-night bar in Austin, Texas, Jackson Station offered swinging, crotch-grinding rhythm and blues and soul music, stuff that would keep the crowd dancing and drinking, hot and horny. From 1970 to 1976, the One Night was the unofficial home of the blues in Austin, and an old Stevie Ray Vaughan, 1954 to 1990, haunt. A few years later, Jackson Station would emerge in Hodges, South Carolina, hoisting its own tent as a part of a larger blues revival across the United States. The One Night was a dark, dank, wonderfully forbidden place. Patrons entered the old stone building by walking through the frame of an upright coffin. Once inside, the smell of stale beer, yesterday's smoke, and puke immediately filled the nostrils. The cluttered objet de junk hanging from the ceiling, old kitchen sinks, bicycle tires, mangled appliances, sent up warning flags that this was not a joint for the meek or faint of heart. Jackson Station was probably not quite as malodorous as the One Night, and the decor was likely much more fabulous, but there was certainly a family resemblance between the two venues. Tipitina's, the iconic New Orleans music club, also a product of the 1970s, provides another point of comparison. On the West Coast, Jewel's Catch One in Los Angeles had similarities to Jackson Station in that it also provided a safe space for gay and lesbian people to congregate. In South Carolina, one might find a scene approximating aspects of Jackson Station at the Garden and Gun Club in Charleston of the late 1970s and the early 1980s. Despite such likenesses to these other musical establishments, however, Jackson Station was in a class of its own. The place was a haven for blues fans, wanderers, lost hippies, beat poets, and anyone else seeking a good time. For many musicians and patrons, Jackson Station embodied the coolest blues bar and music scene the SC upstate has ever seen. For more than a decade, that old railroad depot in Hodges was a beacon for blues and alternative music across the Southeast. It breathed life into the careers of old musicians and nurtured younger talent on their way to success. However, the magic ended in April 1990. A horrible crime was committed at the club. Jackson Station shut down. This book tells the story of Jackson Station. The people who owned the place, the folks who worked there, the patrons who drank there, and the musicians who played there. Jackson Station was a key institution in South Carolina's upstate and was an essential part of its community. In the pages that follow, I explain how Jackson Station came into being in the first place, how it flourished as a music club, and how it has faded into oblivion. Research for this project began in earnest in May 2014. The resulting text is a mixture of cultural sociology, ethnomusicology, social history, and literary nonfiction. The mode of inquiry is historical and qualitative. The historical part of the research process involved the study of primary historical texts such as old newspapers, police reports, court transcripts, Jackson Station pamphlets, band posters, photographs, and live recordings from the club itself. The qualitative part of the research process involved conducting about 65 in-depth interviews, either in person or over the telephone, with various individuals who, in their capacity as patrons, friends, or musicians, had important information or stories about Jackson Station. Jackson Station functioned as both destination and way station for music lovers in the area. It provided a space for social action that created memories that live today. Jackson Station's reputation as one of the more significant blues bars in the Southeast has long been recognized by touring musicians of that era. It is rightly noted as being exceptional by Emily Edwards in her excellent study of Southern drink houses. While there has been a number of previously written partial accounts of Jackson Station, the whole story of this legendary Southern blues bar, from its inception to its tragic finale, has yet to be told. 1. Carolina Drama. A bar is just a church where they serve beer. Jim White. Parents in Greenwood County warned their children not to go to Jackson Station. "My daddy would not let me go up there," said Taylor Wilson Tucker, owner of Thayer's Boutique in Uptown Greenwood, South Carolina. The worry was that their otherwise respectable sons and daughters might get into trouble up at Jackson Station or Jackson's, as the locals called it, a music club with a reputation for being a gay bar, drug den, and place for wild parties lasting until the sun came up. Nothing good ever happens on the streets after midnight, was the collective old-timer wisdom, and ever thus, advice shrugged off dismissively by a generation used to late nights suffered without too many consequences other than a lack of sleep and the occasional hangover. But what happened in the early hours of April 7, 1990, was a reckoning of sorts, suggesting that maybe the elders had been right after all. This is what their parents had been warning them about. Something sinister, and even quite evil, was in the woods of the South Carolina backcountry that night. South Carolina blues legend Drink Small had just finished his last set of the night when he was approached by the piano player in the legendary blues band. Along with Drink Small, the band had been sharing the billing at Jackson Station with saxophonist Fats Jackson and singer Sweet Betty, both from Atlanta, Georgia. The musician told Small that someone had jumped Gerald Jackson in the parking lot. "Gerald is out there lying on the ground," the man said to him. Drink Small went to the front door of the club, walked down the ramp, and out into the parking lot. He saw Gerald on his back. "It was a bad blow," remembers Small. He says, blood was gushing from Gerald's head. About a dozen people soon circled 43-year-old Gerald Jackson, who was gurgling, grasping for life, and coming in and out of consciousness. It was a horrible, chaotic scene. It was 3:30 on a Saturday morning. Jackson Station was an all-night club, often staying open until 5 a.m. or later. Even at this hour, there was still a crowd of about 150 people at the club. Late-night partiers and blues enthusiasts had driven to the rural town of Hodges, located in the northwest portion of South Carolina, from places like Charleston, Columbia, and Greenville to see the show. 10 minutes earlier, they would have been ordering beer, doing shots, wolfing down a spur burger, or trying to get the phone number of the person at the end of the bar. "Ain't no more playing that night," reflects Drink Small. People were confused, angry, and upset. Manic revelry quickly gave way to collective trauma. Inebriated customers wandered around aimlessly, buzzes suddenly killed, trying to figure out what had just happened, who was responsible, and what to do next. At 3:34 a.m., an emergency call was placed to the Greenwood County Sheriff's Office. There had been an assault and battery at Jackson Station. Sergeant Randy Miles, who was attending to an incident in Ware Shoals, South Carolina, about 10 miles up the road, told the dispatcher he was on his way. He sped south on U.S. 25, pulling into the Jackson Station parking lot at 3:47 a.m., found the victim lying on the ground, severely bleeding with a large laceration to the right side of his head. Miles saw about 15 to 20 people in the parking lot, all gathered around a little huddle over someone. Dirk Armstrong, a bartender at Jackson Station and a close friend of Gerald and Steve, was one of the first to get to Gerald. He had run out of the club at the very moment a white pickup truck was peeling out of the lot. Armstrong knelt beside his injured friend. He tried to staunch the flow of blood coming from the deep gash in Gerald's head. Originally from Tampa, Florida, Armstrong was a recent graduate of Erskine College in Due West, South Carolina, a tiny town 10 miles northwest of Hodges. Dirk had attended Erskine from 1984 to 1989, graduating with a biology degree. He started coming to Jackson Station within a month or 6 weeks of first going up to Erskine. He appreciated the very welcoming environment and its impressive selection of beer. He swiftly became friends with Gerald and Steve. Soon, he was working at Jackson Station on the weekends. He started by spinning records in the DJ room and then wormed his way into the kitchen. From there, Dirk further inserted himself into the whole organization. Before long, he was working behind the bar and later would host a new wave night, Dirk's night out, every Tuesday. Dirk also helped Gerald book bands. "It was kind of a 24/7 thing," Dirk says about working at Jackson Station. "Always keeping up the yard and trying to keep the fence up to keep the cows in." Yet such memories would be years away from where Armstrong was at that moment, sitting out in the dirt parking lot at Jackson Station with a bloody T-shirt in his hand, trying to keep Gerald Jackson alive. 2. Gerald Jackson. The entrance to hell is not far from Hodges, South Carolina. Gerald Jackson. The tragedy was that Gerald got along with everybody. Gerald Thomas Jackson was born in Greenwood, South Carolina, on October 10, 1946, and raised up the road in the small town of Hodges. A Vietnam veteran and an openly gay man, Jackson was a bit of an anomaly, even for the rural South Carolina upstate of his time. Gerald's parents were Matthew Edgar Ed Jackson, 1903 to 1959, and Elizabeth Davis Jackson, 1922 to 2001. Born in Bamberg, South Carolina, Matthew Edgar Jackson had graduated from Greenwood High School and briefly attended Clemson College. He had moved to Hodges in 1939. His parents were Arnold and Mary Elizabeth Smith Jackson. Jenny Anna Elizabeth Davis was originally from Whitmire, South Carolina. The daughter of Clarence and Alma Butler Davis, Gerald's mother was 21 and living in Greenwood when she married 39-year-old Ed Jackson on September 4, 1943. Gerald's sister, Ellen, was born in 1944. The family lived at 4113 Moorfield Street, at the intersection of SC 178 and US 25. It was a good location. The Jackson family had been merchants in the area for several generations. Gerald Jackson's grandfather, Arnold Jackson, 1876 to 1946, had opened a general store in Hodges in 1919. "We had a general store that was known as Jackson Station," Gerald Jackson later told his friends and customers. "There was an electric trolley running from Greenville to Augusta, and it had a stop right here." After Arnold Jackson passed away, Gerald's parents started running the general store themselves. Hodges resident John Sanders recalls that Ed Jackson was a big, overweight guy. Sanders remembers the Jackson General Store this way. He ran a bar. They had draft beer and bar stools. He sold chicken feed to candy. They sold gas. Out to the side, he had a garage. He had an old black guy do mechanic work. The Jackson business was one of the larger general stores in the area. It had everything. They had gas pumps. They had a meat counter. They sold fresh meat out of a cooler. The small town of Hodges had been named in honor of Major George Washington Hodges, 1792 to 1876. Gerald Jackson would boast, "In earlier days, Hodges was a thriving railroading center and farming town." Although today Hodges appears rather sedate, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, it was known as a rough place with a reputation for drinking, gambling, and other mayhem. Gerald claimed that Hodges was often referred to as a hellhole with five bars, saloons, and only four stores. There was a time when a person could get off a train and drink in any of several bars, watch a horse race, and witness a cockfight before the next train came along. The town gained the name of Hell because of the frequent shootings and cuttings, Gerald had said, which led to one of his infamous tales. This was a story about a drunk who got on the train at Columbia without a ticket. When the conductor checked him and found he did not have a ticket, he asked him where he wanted to get off. The drunk is said to have muttered drunkenly, "I want off at Hell." The conductor then replied, "In that case, we'll have to let you off at Hodges." Gerald would often joke to his patrons, "The entrance to Hell is not far from Hodges, South Carolina." Hodges resident and local historian James Butch Emerson Riddle remembers his grandfather, Guy Emerson, telling him that the town's two churches had come into Hodges after the Civil War to clean up the apparent immorality. Due to their efforts, he says the town adopted a 100-year moratorium on selling alcohol within city limits. Starting in the mid-1800s and lasting for over 100 years, Hodges was an important node on the regional railroad network. The railway was so central to the town's identity that in its early years, the town was referred to as Hodges Depot, and even earlier as Cokesbury Depot. Cokesbury, an even smaller village, now known mainly for historic Cokesbury College, 2 miles to the east and established in 1824, was the settlement originally served by Hodges Depot. Later, the depot part of the name fell away, and the town simply became known as Hodges. Before long, Hodges started developing as a town in its own right. On November 2, 1871, the Abbeville Press and Banner reported that Hodges Depot, as is known to our readers, is one of our most thriving railroad villages, located at the junction of the Abbeville Branch with the Greenville and Columbia Railroad, and taking its name from General G.W. Hodges, the head of a large and influential family, and himself one of the best representatives of man and citizen. A new impetus has been given to the business prosperity of the place since the war. The Hodges Train Depot was the hub of the community, offering jobs as well as entertainment for the people of Hodges. As Vicki Thomas wrote in the Greenwood Index Journal in 1975, day and night clerks were needed for the depot 7 days a week, and someone was hired to keep train engines fired up each weekend when the train crews would go out of town. Eventually, automobiles and 18-wheeler tractor trailers replaced the trains. The Jackson Station General Store became a Gulf filling station. Ed Jackson took over the business from his father in 1946. He and Elizabeth put a cafe in the store and sold hot dogs and hamburgers because so many truck drivers were stopping here. Gerald would say that, at the time, ours was the biggest country store on that part of Highway 25. A Greyhound bus stop and ticket counter allowed easy access to travel across the country. As a boy, Gerald went to West Hodges Elementary School, now Hodges Elementary. He was 12 when his father died of a heart attack on the morning of January 17, 1959. Ed Jackson also left his widow, Elizabeth, who was 37 years old. Daughter Ellen was 14. John Sanders said, after Gerald's dad passed away, his mother couldn't deal with running the store by herself, so she rented out the space. A family moved in and lived in the back of the building. The business did not do well, and the store eventually went down the hill. Despite his father's death, Gerald was successful at school, excelling in music and art. He was a soloist in the boys' chorus in the fifth grade. In April 1960, he played Father Bear in the spring production of Goldilocks Adventure. In 1961, Gerald, now a student at Northside Junior High School, earned second place for selling $26 worth of tickets to the Pancake Jamboree, a fundraiser for new uniforms for the marching band. When he was 15, Gerald won third place in a poster competition about traffic safety awareness and had his picture featured in the Greenwood Index Journal. Gerald continued to shine at Greenwood High School, then located in downtown Greenwood. During Christmas 1963, 17-year-old Gerald organized a carol sing on the Hodges Town Square. The event featured the Greenwood High School marching band and choirs from Hodges churches. About 200 people showed up for the holiday cheer before heading to the Methodist Church for refreshments. In the spring of 1964, Gerald was an editor and reporter with the Greenwood Trade and Industrial Club with an expressed interest in woodworking. At Greenwood High, Gerald was the leader, drum major, of the marching band. "That's the queen out there prancing," laughs an old friend and Greenwood native Lynn Johnson, who went to high school with Jackson. Lynn first met Gerald when they took a literature class together their sophomore year. They would become lifelong friends. Lynn first remembers speaking to Gerald in the school lunchroom. "He and I just hit it off," she says. "We were just good buddies. That was the beginning of a fabulous relationship." In the spring of 1965, Gerald worked as a school AV, audiovisual assistant, and provided technical support for the Greenwood High School Talent Showcase. He was on the decorating committees for the junior prom in April 1966 and the midwinter ball in January 1967. After graduating from Greenwood High in the spring of 1967, Gerald enrolled at the Greenwood College of Commerce and earned a junior accounting degree in 1968. He also attended Lander College. It was around this time that he decided to join the armed forces. In the summer of 1969, Gerald completed a 14-week hospital man apprentice training course at the Naval Training Center in Great Lakes, Illinois, where he received instruction in patient care, the study of anatomy and physiology, minor surgery, the nature and prevention of communicable diseases, and the administering of medicines. Later that year, Gerald underwent additional training at the Marines Field Medical School at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. In that course, he was taught field first aid, preventative medicine, sanitation, and weapons orientation. In the fall of 1969, Gerald shipped out to Vietnam. During his tour of duty, he worked as a Navy corpsman. This role is essentially that of a military first responder. The main job of the corpsman was to attend to wounded Marines on the battlefield. 645 Navy corpsmen would die during the Vietnam conflict. The motto of the corpsman was, "To hell and back for a wounded Marine." They would be called to the field of battle with the command, "Corpsman up." As Lieutenant Chesty Puller explains it, the Navy corpsmen were the Marine's doctors. There's none better in the business than a Navy corpsman. Bill Coleman of South Carolina, who was a close friend and neighbor to Gerald and Steve, says Gerald was attached to a Marine company. He was the only one out there to give the last rites to a Catholic Marine. He gave them morphine, stuffed their you-know-what back into their body cavities, and was there to administer, well, his last breath. Gerald had that experience. Being a corpsman would turn out to be a prescient calling for Gerald Jackson, as he spent so much of his life taking care of other people. Jack McConnell, a bartender at Jackson Station while a student at Erskine College from 1978 to 1982, says, "Gerald's whole background was not fighting and killing people in Vietnam. It was trying to save people. A lot of the skills he had from that time he carried over into his bar business. In the Navy, he had received valuable training as a neuropsychiatric technician. Years later, Gerald would refer to his status at Jackson Station as part nursemaid. However, Gerald did not talk about Vietnam much. "He probably saw a lot," says old friend and Jackson Station regular Roland Tranter, "since he didn't talk about it. Most of the ones that kind of had it rough don't talk about it, and the ones who didn't do anything make up a lot of stuff." Another close friend, Anita Clinton, says that what Gerald saw and experienced in Vietnam haunted him. "You could tell in his eyes," she said, "to be there at such a time of pain and anguish at the end of so many lives as they crossed over, and not being able to help them." Somewhere along the way, Gerald realized he was gay. David Goldman, Gerald's longtime friend, suggests that there are two main options facing people who know they are gay. They run for it or choose to accept it. "From what he told me," Goldman said, "Gerald embraced it from a young age. In his prime, Jackson stood about 6 feet tall. He had expressive blue eyes and blonde hair. In middle age, he developed a paunch, but is said to have worn it well. Despite his committed relationship with Steve, Gerald would have regular liaisons with other men, some of whom were half his age. High school friend Lynn Johnson says she knew that Gerald was gay early on. "I had a gay cousin, so I knew what gay was in 1962, Johnson said. "I knew what was going on." Johnson thinks Gerald did not have any boyfriends in high school, but that he probably was infatuated with 15 boys. Gerald's manner and appearance did not always signal his sexual identity. Many people who met Gerald for the first time did not realize he was gay. "You would never know that Gerald was gay," says friend Bonnie Capps, a Jackson Station regular. "He looked like Uncle Bob down here." Yet Gerald Jackson never denied his sexuality, which is remarkable given the cultural norms of his geographic location. Musician Billy Wirtz says that Gerald was totally out when he met him in 1982. He said Gerald joked with him that there wasn't a whole lot to do in Hodges other than fuck some of the farm boys every now and then. "It would have been difficult being openly gay in any part of the country in the 1970s and 1980s, let alone the conservative South. Yet Gerald was quite integrated into, and in some ways at the center of, his rural Southern community. Perhaps Gerald's experience in Vietnam and his status as a veteran mitigated some of the stigma, whether self-imposed or applied by others, that his sexual orientation may have caused him. When he came back from Vietnam, he was out," said Lynn Johnson. "He didn't care. He was never one to push it in your face, but he was just a gay man. He'd seen war." Johnson says Gerald's attitude was, "I'm coming back and this is who I am, and you like it or lump it." David Goldman says that Gerald taught him many lessons over the years. The most important one was that being gay has nothing to do with being weak or getting walked on. In a time when the dominant representations of gay men in America were very limited, The media portrayed gays either as sissies, monsters, or as objects of ridicule. Gerald and Steve taught people that there not only is absolutely nothing wrong with being gay.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?